Shrink Wrap Radio number 441, Psychosynthesis, Past, Present, and Future, with Molly Young Brown.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Molly Young Brown, MA and Master's in Divinity, counselor, coach, author, and longtime practitioner of psychosynthesis. For more information about Molly Young Brown, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Molly Young Brown, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, I'm delighted to have you, and I got your name from Mark Horowitz, whom I recently interviewed on human systems theory, and he suggested that you'd be the go-to person for me to interview about psychosynthesis.
Well, I've been involved with it since, 1971, I think, something like that. So it's been a while.
Yeah, I should mention that I took a short course through the Esalen Institute in the early 70s about psychosynthesis. I seem to recall it was taught by Jim and Susan Varju. And I was very impressed by what I learned at that time, but have really lost touch with it over the years, especially since I haven't been practicing therapy for some time.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you first hear about and get involved with psychosynthesis?
Well, it's really interesting because must have been the late 60s, because it was before my second son was born, and he was born in 69. So it must have been just before that, 68 or something. I took a course through Esalen. At that time, they had programs in San Francisco, not just at the center down in Big Sur. And so I took a course with Jim Fadiman called The Psychology of Personal Development or something. Something like that. And it was just kind of a general course in personal growth that was, you know, popular at the time. But he was bringing a lot from this book called Psychosynthesis by Roberto Assagioli. And I was very intrigued. So I purchased a copy of the book for my husband for Christmas. I think it was a Christmas present. And I, looking back on that now, I thought, my gosh, we just spent like hardly any money on each other at Christmas back then. But anyway, I got the book, and he read it, and I read it, and we both enjoyed it a lot, and thought it was, you know, it was very much in keeping with our interests in both psychology and Eastern philosophies. Oh, and then later, our first training in psychosynthesis was at University of UC Santa Barbara. And the Varjus came down at the invitation. Actually, my husband was running a program there at the time and invited them to come down and give a workshop. So we took our first workshop from them as well, and then decided we wanted to do their training, and, you know, and the rest is history.
Yeah, small world. Now, I see that you've got both a master's degree and a master's in divinity. Did you already have those degrees at that time? Were you already a counselor or therapist or anything?
No. I actually went back later and got a master's in humanistic and transpersonal psychology through a program that was a kind of a school without walls. It was an early version of that. Through the University of Redlands. And I did, at the time I was in San Francisco at the psychosynthesis center that had moved to San Francisco in the meantime, and doing training there, and I incorporated my training into my degree program. So I really kind of got a master's degree in psychosynthesis, although it wasn't called that.
So I got
that later. And then after that is when I started, working with clients and so forth.
Yeah. So what was it about the approach of psychosynthesis that drew you to it?
Well, it was partly that it had this whole spiritual dimension without its being a religion in any way. It was saying, how can you have a complete psychology if you don't include the spiritual dimension, which is such an important part of almost everyone's lives. Even if they reject it altogether, it's part of their life in a sense. So that was one of the things that really attracted us. And it was a very positive psychology. It wasn't based on pathology and you know, what can go wrong, but rather how can people become, you know, more fulfilled and more filling up their potential. So we were, that's what attracted us both to it.
You know, that makes it sound pretty contemporary, because I think that the integration of spirituality into psychotherapy is more widely accepted today than maybe it was back then. And also the emphasis on sort of positive dimensions of growth has been really manifested recently in the whole coaching movement.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. In fact, sometimes I call myself a life coach nowadays. Mm-hmm. I realize that there's the coaching field tries to make a clear distinction between therapy and coaching. I find it difficult to make that distinction. But I would say that my work would tend to be more in the sort of side of the coaching and less. I don't call myself a therapist.
Okay.
I've always called myself a guide or a counselor, but I haven't called myself a therapist. And that's partly for legal reasons. I'm not licensed.
Okay.
And so legally, I really can't call myself a therapist, and that's fine. I don't mind.
Okay. Now, before we go further, perhaps we should back up a bit and have you tell us about the founder of Psychosynthesis, Roberto Assagioli.
Right. I will do so. He was a lovely, lovely man. After we had studied our initial training in psychosynthesis, and we knew that Assagioli was quite elderly at the time. He was in his 80s and not in the best of health. And so I just felt this. We've got to go see him. We have this opportunity to go and study with a wise man, and we've got to do it. So we borrowed money from my parents, and you know, we really went to a great deal of effort to go and study with him. And he had first gotten the idea of psychosynthesis, and he wrote a thesis in 1912 in which he started to present his ideas about psychosynthesis. And actually, the term came from Freud. Freud said, after psychoanalysis, we should have a psychosynthesis, but he never did it. Mm-hmm. And Assagioli picked that up and said, yes, we need to have, you know, not just pick the person apart, but then put them back together again.
Right.
In a functioning way. So yeah. Not that we put anybody together, but help people, you know, integrate them, the various aspects of their personality. So, and he also felt that at the time that there needed to be the spiritual dimension. And he'd studied Eastern religions. I mean, he studied everything there was to study. He was a very integrative sort of person, in that he was putting together what he was learning from Buddhism and Hinduism and yoga and Christianity and Judaism and, you know, name it, he was including it. I think maybe I don't know if he studied Islam. He may have. I haven't seen a lot of references to that.
Now, he was trained as an MD, is that right?
That's right. He was an MD. He was a psychiatrist, essentially. And he wanted to make psychosynthesis be acceptable to the kind of conventional, you know, mainstream medical world. And so he found ways of languaging what he was doing in ways that he thought would be more acceptable. So he never talked about God, for example. He talks about self with a capital S. And really, the self of each of us is this dimension in which we are in contact with everything else, the universal, as now, well as the individual.
Now, of course, the capital S self, I believe, comes from Jung. And so I'm wondering, did he have personal contact with Jung, since they would have been contemporaries to some degree?
Yes, he did. And I don't know that it came from Jung or if it was just an idea that was out there and they both latched onto it. He doesn't really, doesn't consider Jung his teacher, but rather, as you say, a colleague. And apparently they did have some, you know, correspondence and so forth. So they knew each other and may have influenced each other's thought as well. But it's kind of not, I don't see psychosynthesis as a spin-off from Jungian psychology. I see it as a parallel movement, shall we say.
Uh-huh. Now, one of the stories I recall about Asagioli was supposedly, well, I'm sure it's more than supposedly, that he was thrown into prison by Mussolini during the Nazi era in Italy.
That's true. That's true. And he spent quite a while in solitary confinement. And he decided that he would use that time to meditate and study and write. It's what he did. So rather than being traumatized by that, he managed to turn it into like a retreat for himself.
Yeah, that's the thing that really struck me when I heard that story was his and hopefully I've kind of taken it in that he kind of reframed it and said,
right.
Well, I've always been such a busy professional and I've never really had time to meditate to the degree that I would like to. And so this is kind of like my opportunity to be in a monastery.
That's right. That's what he did.
Yeah.
And I suppose he was not, you know, particularly abused or anything. He was able to, well, being in solitary for him was, you know, probably to his advantage, and that he might have been bothered by the, you know, the mainstream prison population. And because he was a small, you know, a small man and slight in build, and he could have been, you know, tormented. But so it may have been to his advantage he was in solitary. Actually, what was more traumatic was when he was trying, before he was arrested, he and his son were fleeing, trying to get away from the fascists and out literally sleeping in people's barns and things like that. And his son contracted tuberculosis and died a few years later, which was a huge, huge tragedy for him. And he,
sure.
He was very, very fond of his son, and he was his only son, so only child. So that was much more traumatic than solitary for him.
Uh-huh. Now, since you had the opportunity to meet him in person and to work with him, how would you describe his personality? How did he impress you?
Well, he was kind of sparkly. interestingly enough, my husband tells this wonderful story about when we went in to meet him for the first time in his study. This was in Florence. And he shook his hand. He had the feeling that if he pulled it up on his hand, that Asagioli would float off of the floor. He just had this quality of lightness about him. Probably both meanings of the word light. And he was quite a lot of humor, not in the way of cracking jokes, but just seeing the humorous side of almost everything.
Yeah.
And he gave us some homework to do. We were to each of us to write every day a letter to our higher self. And that kind of, the letter to the higher self is still a technique I still use today and I certainly share with other people. And you don't have to write it to a higher self. You can write it to Earth. You can write it to the goddess. You can write it to the divine mother. You can write it to whatever you want to, you know, however you want, whatever terms you want to use.
And what does that evoke?
Well, what happens is, I would write a letter and I'd say, well, I don't even know if you exist and what the heck, and I would write my doubts and fears and everything.
Good.
And then I would find myself writing and I would realize that it was the response. It wouldn't like it was dictated, but it would say, I would say, well, perhaps such and such and such. And then I would realize that that was kind of, it was like it was a dialogue.
Yes.
And I would get insights. I would get insights into whatever I was writing about. And I still, mm-hmm. like I said, to this day, if I'm in a quandary about something, I'll write a letter as I address it to various various divinities, whatever I feel like in the moment, and it always helps me to. It's like sink into my own inner wisdom. I think is mm-hmm. really what it does.
Yes,
and clear away the casual thoughts and confusions and concerns.
I'm curious, since that was a daily exercise, was that also shared in the group? Did you share what you had written?
Yes, we did, if we wanted to, but the group was only the two of us. So it was, were having private consultations with him.
Uh-huh.
And we also did a daily free drawing. And he said, just draw. It wasn't an answer to a question or anything. It was just whatever images come to mind, just draw them. And he would look at those with us as well and ask us questions and make comments about it. It wasn't like he was interpreting in them. It was more like he was, having a dialogue with us about our drawings and about our letters.
I gather you didn't go to see him explicitly for psychotherapy, but I'm wondering if as a result of your contact with him and doing these exercises and so on, if there were personal issues that were resolved or a sense of personal growth that you could share with us.
Oh, very, very definitely. It wasn't so much, like you said, personal issues that were resolved. It was more that I came away with a lot more confidence, mm-hmm. a lot more sense of my direction in life. Mm-hmm. I made a drawing while I was there, or may have been after I returned, that had a slogan, and it said, "Commend the day to your higher self and do only the task at hand." And that was hugely important for me at that time. I had two small children, and I was very much into the household, although I was also working part-time outside the home. And somehow, the busyness of life and everything, it just really helped to sort of say, okay, I can turn over the big picture to some kind of larger intelligence. It would be like what the 12-step people call the higher power.
Mm-hmm.
And then just address whatever it was I needed to do, rather than thinking, well, after I do this, and I've got to remember to do that, and thinking about this thing while I'm doing this other thing, I could just, it helped me focus, and I don't know how I got that. I mean, I can't say that Asa Joly told me that or anything, but somehow the process of working with him, I came away with that, a greater sense of focus and direction.
Yeah, that was kind of a message from your higher self, and sounds like it was kind of prioritizing from a what we could call a higher perspective about, okay, what's really important.
Right, right. And the other piece was that we did talk to him about our children, and our older son at the time was sort of kind of stormy emotionally, and he gave us some really good advice about how to work with him and be with him. And he also told us to, at one point I was very worried about our kids. They were 4 and 7, and we'd left them with our grandparents, and we knew they were in good hands. But the communication between Italy and the United States was really, really poor in those days. And so we hadn't heard from them for like 2 weeks, and I was getting quite concerned. And I told him about that, and he said, well, leave your children in the hands of their higher selves. They'll be fine. And I said, oh, but it's only normal for a mother to worry. And he said, do you want to be a normal mother?
Quite a challenge.
Yes, right. So, there's a lot of those little moments that we had with him where he said something that I have remembered to this day. And
a little bit of a Zen teacher.
Yeah. He was a Zen teacher. Very much so. And we also asked him a lot of theoretical questions. We had a lot of theoretical discussions about, various aspects. He had us reading a lot of stuff. And I said, we can't afford to pay you very much. Is there anything I can do? And he had me typing up with carbon copies, 5 carbon copies, because this was, before computers and before things like that. And so I was typing away. We didn't even have good Xerox machines, or at least not in Italy they were. So I was hitting the keys really hard so it would go through 5 layers of carbon copies. And I still have copies of those articles, because I was able to keep the 5th copy. Today, there were things he'd written and interviews he'd had, and there was some really wonderful material in there, and that I have since shared with the larger world, but I've kept my own copies as well.
Well, speaking of the theory, I see that you have authored or co-authored around 6 books, one of which is titled Unfolding Self, The Practice of Psychosynthesis. Mm-hmm. So perhaps you can take us through the theory of psychosynthesis.
Wow.
Is that a big order?
Yeah, that's a big order.
That's a whole workshop, I'm sure.
I'm sure. I'll give you what I believe to be the essentials. I already have talked about the idea of the self, or the higher self. Now, he called it the higher self. Many of us now just call it self, because we don't want to even use the, but he did. So the idea that we have this higher self, or you could call it a soul, or you could call it spirit, you know, whatever name you want to put on it, but it is a dimension of us that is both universal and individual. So it's kind of like the universal energy as it's funneled down into this particular incarnation or this particular individual. And then there's the personal self, which is a reflection of the higher self and is more like who we think we are. The I, when I say I am going downtown, that's the personal self that is, I'm speaking of. Or as I'm speaking to you right now, I'm speaking out of the personal self. So part of the idea in psychosynthesis is to align the personal self with the higher self so that it can be informed and inspired by that higher consciousness. And both levels of self have 2 dimensions. One is awareness and the other is will. Now, Asajoli really, really emphasized the will. Mm-hmm. A lot of people in psychology at the time were very much emphasizing self-awareness. It was a well-known, psychoanalysis is really self-awareness, becoming aware of your own inner dynamics and where they come from and so forth. But he felt that that wasn't enough, that we also needed to act on that. On that insight and bring it into our lives in tangible ways. So the will became as important as awareness. And if you stop and think about it, they're very closely connected, because when you decide to pay attention to something, you're using your will to make that choice to pay attention to this instead of that. And the other aspect is once you become aware of some dynamic, it almost always flows that you're going to act differently as a result. You're going to make different choices as a result of that insight. So
to me, the will also connotes some kind of driving force. In other words, you could become aware of some things and not change.
Right.
But to have some kind of a resolution to move on the basis of that insight, to me, that is, I would think of that as being a will.
Yes, yes. And that's exactly the way that he thinks about it. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to say that he would offer these ideas of self or higher self or personal self or will or anything else as a proposition. He would say, this is what I've come to. This is the conclusions I've come to. But take these ideas and work with them and look at your own personal experience. And you may want to do it, define it somewhat differently or, change the terminology or whatever. And that's fine. He really wanted people to take his ideas and run with them rather than it for his teachings to become a dogma.
That's my kind of guy.
Yeah, mine too. So I've always felt free. Like I said, now a lot of us don't call it the higher self anymore. We just call it self. And the reason why is because of a sense of higher being better. And we, wanting to move away from up there, high is good, and down here on the ground is somehow inferior. Mm-hmm. But one of his students, Piero Ferrucci, says he didn't mean by higher, he didn't mean better. He just meant a broader perspective. Like if you're up in the sky and you're flying around as an eagle, you see a lot more territory than you do when you're down on the ground. And that's really what he meant by higher. So I appreciate that. I think that that was probably what he meant, but how other people hear it is another story. So
So
that was one change that some people have made, and some people who are more wanting to adhere to the original teachings are upset by that. But some of us say, well, he told us to take these ideas and evolve them and run with them and develop them. So that's what we're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. So those- and I remember a time in the 70s when people were going to India and there were gurus coming to this country and people would talk about this guru or that guru being very high, and this guru is higher than that other guru, and that I always felt uncomfortable with that kind of talk.
Yeah, that I think that's a fault of our Western civilization that we do tend to create these hierarchies and create, the great chain of being and stuff like that. When, mm-hmm. of course, nowadays with eco-psychology and areas like that in play, we try to think of we're just all part of the web of life, and there is no better or worse or higher or lower. So mm-hmm. it's partly the times have changed, and so those are some of the key concepts. Another one that is very important, as far as I'm concerned, is the idea of disidentification. And a lot of people have complained about what a mouthful that word is, but we haven't really been able to come up with anything better, because when we identify with something, we attach our, it's like we become attached to it. We think we are that. So, a gross example would be somebody who becomes identified with the car he drives, and he's got to have the latest, fanciest, most powerful car. And, or it somehow reflects on him as a person if he doesn't have this, fancy car.
Yeah.
Well, that's a kind of a obvious example. It's really a lot more subtle than that. So I'm a mother. I have two grown children. I have grandchildren, actually. And I could become identified with being a mother. That's who I am. Well, I'm a lot more than a mother. Yes, I'm a mother, but I'm also a writer. I'm also a teacher, and I'm also somebody who loves to go out on walks in nature, and et cetera, et cetera. So disidentification in psychosynthesis is very, very key. It's when you step back from these identifications you have and look at them with some degree of objectivity. And it's not to get rid of them or to spurn them or anything like that, but it's just to see the dynamics a little more clearly and be able to, for example, if I find myself angry about something, I could just go with the anger and just be pissed off and blah, 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 and probably get a stomachache. Or I could say, oh, boy, I'm feeling angry. What's that about? And step back, just maybe a half a step. Oh, well, this happened and that happened. And it's my, you know, I can examine that anger and understand it more. It doesn't mean that I'm going to say, well, I shouldn't be angry.
You know, you're speaking of disidentification also makes me think of all the interest these days about mindfulness. And it sounds a bit like a what would be called a mindful practice.
Absolutely. I think it's the same, talking about the same dynamic or the same interaction.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Now, I'm doing a series on what might be called, quotes, parts therapies. For example, Freud's theory has its parts, id, ego, superego, conscious and unconscious. Jung has the collective unconscious, the shadow, the anima, anonymous, the self, and other archetypes. And Fritz Perls has parts such as top dog and underdog, and transactional analysis has parent, adult, and child. And, of course, there's a lot more to each of those theories than just the parts, and I'm sure that's true of psychosynthesis as well. But if we look at it for a moment through that filter, what are the component parts?
Are you still there?
I am.
Yeah, it cut out for a second. What are the components? Well, if I think about parts in psychosynthesis, I think about subpersonalities.
Okay.
And in subpersonalities are little sort of almost autonomous ways of being, behavior, like little packets of behavior and feelings and thoughts that we develop. And they can be quite useful. It's not that they're all bad, but often we retain them like habits long past their point of effectiveness. So, for example, a girl growing up in a home where with maybe very kind of demanding parents might develop a subpersonality of being very meek and obedient and fearful. Well, it probably helps her keep her out of trouble in that family. But when she grows up, if she continues to be meek and fearful and placating and so forth, she's obviously going to suffer some unfortunate consequences from that. She needs to, you know, leave that subpersonality behind. And maybe it only comes up in certain instances. Maybe it only comes up if there's a someone that reminds her of her father in her, you know, with her.
Yeah.
And then it might only come up then. But it could really be a disadvantage to continue to act that way. So there are patterns, but they include feelings. I mean, because when she's identified with that subpersonality, she feels a certain way, she thinks a certain way, and she acts a certain way. And so, like I say, it's like a whole package.
Yeah.
And this is where disidentification comes in, because as she can step back from that and say, oh, what's going on here? Why am I acting this way? And what's going on? She can then begin to make different choices, for one thing.
Let me ask you to move your mic away from
Again.
Your mouth a
okay.
little bit more. Yeah.
Okay.
And I'm wondering, are there any subpersonalities that are sort of cataloged as you know, that are identified as sort of frequent kinds of sub-personalities?
I would say so, but it's not as codified as those other systems you mentioned.
Okay.
I mean, like top dog and underdog and stuff like that. But most of us have a critic.
Yes.
Some kind of a critical sub-personality. Maybe we have a bully. I'm thinking of that might be fairly common, but generally the bully is, we're bullying ourselves rather than somebody else. I think the critic is probably the most common one. But like I said, it's not codified in the way that those other systems you mentioned. It's more just the concept that each person is made up of a whole bunch of sub-personalities.
Okay.
And they come into play at different, you know, in different circumstances. And some of them are useful and some of them are not.
And is part of the approach then the integration or synthesis of these sub-personalities?
Absolutely. And again, we can't get rid of them. We can't say, well, I don't want to be that way anymore. I mean, we might want to say that, but it's not going to happen. That part of us has to be kind of welcomed into the fold and honored for the job it's trying to do, and perhaps given a different job description. That you could say, well, you know, you are trying to protect me from being abused by, you know, a father figure. But it would be much more helpful if you would, I don't know if you would actually say this, but I'm just giving this as an example.
Okay.
It'd be much more helpful if you, when you feel this strong energy coming towards you, that you say, take a deep breath and say to yourself, I'm really stronger than I think I am. So in other words, you find some way of working with that sub-personality so that it continues to be part of you, but it kind of grows up. It kind of adapts itself to the realities of your life at that time rather than still hanging on to old childhood traumas and such.
And would a way of working with those sub-personalities be to dialogue with them either on paper or internally?
Mm-hmm. And actually, Gestalt therapy, which you mentioned earlier, is a technique, if you will, that we often use, where you can suggest that the person imagine the sub-personality in a chair and have a dialogue that way. And you may actually have the person move into the chair and speak to the sub-personality and then move back to another chair, and which is hopefully more the centered, the self. And sometimes another sub-personality will show up, because you'll have the scared child, and then all of a sudden, here's this very critical, parental type figure. And so then you have to work with both of them and find out what they have to offer each other, find out what they really, really need, and then often in imagery you can give them what they need. So let's say the child needs, it's hard to just think of examples off the top of my head, but you can often give them what they need in imagery. So you might give them the sub-personality a cloak that they can wear and feel safe and warm,
mm-hmm.
or a wand or a magic golden ring or whatever in symbology you can find to help that sub-personality let go of its fear and become more integrated with the rest.
I'm glad you mentioned imagery, because I remember from the exposure I had that was one of the more striking features of the approach, the idea that you could be that active a therapist, if you will, to suggest imagery, to suggest images with the idea that this was going to help move things along.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in some quarters that would be kind of a controversial idea about whether or not, A, about being that active, and B, whether or not that really is effective.
Yeah. In the first place, it is, in my experience, it's very effective. Taking someone on a guided imagery journey where they close their eyes and go inside and visualize themselves, say, in a meadow or, you know, whatever the... So there's certain sort of archetypal images that we might tend to use.
Yeah.
If I wanted someone to confront a really negative part of themselves or a scary part, I might have imagined them outside of a cave and have the scary part be inside the cave. But I probably wouldn't tell them what the cave looked like, and I wouldn't tell them what the scary part looked like. I would allow their image to come forward. So I would just sort of set the scene. Imagine yourself in front of a cave.
Yes.
What does the cave look like? You know, what's inside the cave? Can you imagine calling into the cave and asking it to come out? Or do you want to go into the cave? You know, in other words, allowing as much of the imagery to come from the client as possible. So it's their imagery, not mine. However, there are, like I said, there are certain sort of archetypal things that one can do. For example, go up a mountain and find a wise being on the top of the mountain. I try to use being because it might be something other than a human.
Mm-hmm.
So that, again, the suggestions are as broad as possible. The journey up the mountain would be entirely up to the client. I mean, it could be difficult. It could be easy. Just whatever comes up as the person imagines climbing a mountain. But the mountain itself is kind of the archetypal thing.
Yes. I seem to recall an exercise related to that where it was like a triangle and you would have these two opposing sub-personalities, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you were invited to have some imagery, to evoke some imagery associated with each of the two opposing sub-personalities, and then to take them up to the top of the mountain and allow some other integrative image to spontaneously appear.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And the trip up the mountain is important. You don't just pop up there.
Uh-huh.
You have to go up gradually to allow time for that integration to take place.
Mm-hmm.
Also, with the image of the triangle, very important concept in psychosynthesis. It's called the synthesis triangle, where you have two subpersonalities or two conflicting desires or two anything that's a conflict. And like you said, you have an image of one and an image of the other, and you can have your hands held out. So one's in your right hand, one's in your left hand. And again, you'd let the client decide which polarity is in which hand,
uh-huh,
because that could be instructive even in itself. And then you can ask the client to very gradually bring their hands together as if at the top of a triangle.
Uh-huh.
So they're not bringing them together on the same level. They're raising them up and gradually bringing them together. And do it as slowly as needed. And when they get to the top, does an image emerge that is a synthesis of the two original polarities?
What do you think that physical enactment with the hands brings to the party, so to speak?
Well, it gets the body involved, and it makes it more real in a way. It makes it more a physical experience, and anything to make imagery, to help imagery be more vivid and more more real is helpful. You know, drawings are helpful. Often have people do drawings and draw their images. And and again, encourage, like Asa Julie did, for us to just to not plan out the drawing, you know, to just start drawing and let the hands do it. Because through the unconscious, I mean, the unconscious is so amazingly wise and knows so much more than our conscious mind can know. And any way that we have through imagery, through physical movement, through art, through drawing, clay sculpture, anything, to make that, to allow that unconscious to express itself, is very, very helpful.
I'm wondering if there is a case example, either from somebody you worked with or from yourself, where that you could give us of those, of the conflict and the going up to the mountain and what emerged. And I know I didn't prep you for this ahead of time.
Yes,
so
right.
If your memory is anything like mine, it may be challenging.
Yeah, it is difficult to think. I wish I didn't bring a copy of Unfolding Self to the desk with me here. And I might, you know, I probably have some in there that I could mention. But off the top of my head, I'm sorry, I can't think of an example.
Okay, that's fine. Just going back to the parts for a moment, we've got kind of the higher self and the I self, the everyday I self, and the subpersonalities. Is there any other aspect of the theory that could be conceptualized in terms of parts?
Yeah, there's two diagrams that we use. There's the what we call the egg diagram because it's egg shaped.
Yep.
And there's the star diagram. And the egg diagram, in a way, you could think of that as a parts thing, because it's has at the very top of the egg is the higher self, and it's drawn as kind of a radiating center so that there's like radiation light coming out, you know, lines coming out from it. So it's not just a fixed point, but a radiation, radiating center. And then in the middle of the oval or the egg is the eye, a point of the eye or personal self. And there's a dotted line drawn between the higher self and the personal self to indicate that relationship. Then around, there would be a circle around the dot of the eye, and that circle is the field of awareness. So this is what we're aware of at any given time. You know, like I'm sitting here in this chair in this room and talking to you, and this is what I'm aware of. Then outside of that is the middle unconscious. And the middle unconscious is stuff that we're not conscious of at the moment, but we could easily recall.
Mm-hmm.
So I could remember in a moment what I had for dinner last night, or, you know, a place I walked to yesterday, or a conversation I had with my husband, or, you know, whatever. Now, if the conversation was traumatic, it may have been repressed, and then it would go down into the lower unconscious. So the oval is divided into three areas: the higher unconscious, the middle unconscious that has this field of awareness and the dot of the eye in the middle of it, and then the lower unconscious. The lower unconscious contains what we repress, what we've forgotten. It also contains things like the consciousness that keeps our heart beating and keeps us breathing. And so it's not just a place of horrible stuff. It's also just our basic biological functions take place outside of our consciousness most of the time. And then the higher unconscious is kind of our potential. It's insight, it's wisdom, it's what is sort of awaiting to be born or waiting to come into our awareness. So that's the oval diagram. And incidentally, on the outside of the oval diagram is the collective unconscious. So that has that in common with Jungian theory.
Yeah, and I seem to recall that some of those boundaries are drawn with dotted lines to suggest that there's some permeability that,
absolutely,
that is not fixed, but things can move from unconscious to conscious or even from consciousness to unconsciousness.
Absolutely. The every single line in this oval diagram is dotted.
Yeah.
They're all dotted because they're all permeable. And we can talk about even the collective unconscious having those levels, because sometimes, you know, if you go into a room, say some kind of party or organization, and you sense that there's a lot of tension in the room, well, that's probably in the lower collective unconscious. There's something going on that people aren't really aware of, but they can kind of pick up the vibes, if you know what I mean. Uh-huh. Or you can go into a room and people are really, really happy and really open and really excited about something. And so then you could say, well, that's the higher collective unconscious. So, you know, you can have these, the dotted lines that separate these levels of the unconscious extend out. And this is only a model. It's not to say that somewhere in our brain is the higher unconscious and some other place is the lower unconscious. They're all mixed up together. This is just a way of thinking about it.
Yes, yes.
For purposes of discussion. So
right.
The map is not the territory.
Right. Yeah, good point. Now, you mentioned the star diagram as maybe suggesting some other parts. Tell us about that.
Well, Assagioli talked about what he called the psychological functions, and there are six of them. So he had a six-pointed star to indicate them. So each point of the star would be another function, and I'll tell you what they are in a minute. In the middle is the will and the self. So the will is what uses, shall we say, all these psychological functions to function. And they are sensation. This is sort of the basic ones. Desire or impulse. And this is, you know, like hunger and needing to go to the bathroom. I mean, it's real basic stuff.
Uh-huh.
But it could also be psychological desires as well. It isn't just biological. And then we have emotions, and we have thinking. This is our rational thinking mind. And then these two wonderful ones, is one of the things I love about psychosynthesis. Imagination and intuition are given their own place. They are not just feelings and thoughts. They're functions in their own right. And this is one of the things I really value most about psychosynthesis, is that recognition. The role of imagination, as we've just been talking about imagery and how incredibly important it is. And nowadays, with a lot of study of trauma and so forth, you're realizing that imagination is what allows you to figure out a different way of figure out a way out of a bad situation. It uh-huh. isn't just for art and you know having fun. It is actually a very practical survival. And people who have had their imaginations suppressed in some way just have to keep doing things the same way because they don't have any imagination to figure out anything different.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really important. And then intuition is, again, that you could call it also where maybe we have extrasensory perception of various kinds could be part of the intuition. And it's kind of mysterious. We don't know quite how it works, but it seems to be very, very important. And this is part of the reason that I feel I can be more, quote, active as a guide or a counselor or whatever you want to call me, is because I have really learned to trust my intuition. And I've learned to be very careful with it. That is, if I get a hunch about something, I don't necessarily act on it right away. I kind of look at it for a little while, or maybe I'll ask a question to see if that seems to be a good way to go. And I'm just really amazed at how frequently something that I say as an intuition will be a turning point for my client.
Yes.
So there is something there. And like I said, it's mysterious. I don't know exactly how it works, but I know it does work. That I'm somehow tuned in to the client's experience sufficiently that things can come to me, but I'm also not completely caught up in it. So I have a certain amount of objectivity and I can, I'm just amazed at how often an intuition will occur to me that will be instrumental in helping the client.
Sure, I believe that. And, you know, we've seen that psychosynthesis is an extremely integrative approach. Even the name suggests that with synthesis. I'm not sure if it invents anything as much as it integrates some of the strong features of other approaches.
Yeah, I don't know either. I only know that when I early days of studying psychosynthesis, it was the only thing around that I was in touch with, including Jungian. I would have to say that did what it does. And nowadays, all these techniques and concepts and ideas are way, way more common in the culture.
Yes.
I don't think it's necessarily a direct effect of psychosynthesis as a school. I mean, it may or may not be. People may have taken workshops and incorporated the ideas into whatever else they were doing. So it could be partly that. But it's also one of those, the collective unconscious, you know. Acciaiuoli was a little ahead of his time. He came up with these ideas, but they also came into other people's consciousness and were enacted in the same during the same time. So
yeah, I've speculated something similar about humanistic psychology in general, that so much, you know, people say, well, where did that go? And so much of it was just kind of absorbed into the culture that many of the concepts are just considered common wisdom these days.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So I can see something similar there. You know, back in the 70s, there was a proliferation of innovative psychotherapies, and psychosynthesis was one of those that was gaining some notice. However, in recent years, I've not heard anything about psychosynthesis. So the question comes up, which maybe you've just partly answered, what happened to it?
Well, for one thing, in Europe, it is much more successful and active than it is in the United States these days. So I don't know what that's about. I don't know why. The American mindset is just not that open to something as sort of intangible and somewhat mystic as psychosynthesis might be seen as. So that's part of it.
Part of my answer to that is I think in America we use things up really fast.
It's not the soup du jour. It's passé. Now we're on to something else.
Yes, exactly.
And I know a lot of people, actually, some friends who were originally very much involved in psychosynthesis and then went on and got involved in other systems and feel that psychosynthesis is passé. I didn't happen to do that myself, but other people, certainly have. And so that could be part of it.
Yeah.
There was a very unfortunate thing that happened at one of the psychosynthesis centers that kind of got cultish. And that really set psychosynthesis back in the eyes of the, say, humanistic transpersonal movement because of that unfortunate thing that happened.
Yeah.
But that was long ago, and that was over in about the 80s, so I don't know why in 30 years since it hasn't been able to pull out of that. A lot of us who were involved early on are now getting older. I'm 73. We've got people my age and older. Many have died. So it's sort of the original group of teachers is aging and dying, and somehow there doesn't seem to be the next generation coming up. I mean, there are a few, but not as many, and not somehow as outspoken, or I don't know. It's very strange.
Well, probably in years to come, somebody will discover this collection of writings, and it'll get rediscovered and reinvented all over again.
Maybe so.
Yeah. Is there any sort of active organization for psychosynthesis, you know, like the International Organization of Psychosynthesis or anything like that?
Well, there's a national organization, it's not actually, it's North American. We consider ourselves North American, so it includes Canada and Mexico. It is called the Association for the Advancement of Psychosynthesis.
Uh-huh.
And they have conferences about they were having them every year, but now it's gone down to about every two or three years. They're having a conference. There's one in Montreal this summer. So that's a pretty active organization. They also publish an online journal. Used to be paper, but now, of course, it's online. And there are organizations in Europe, several. There's the European, what is it called? Federation of Psychosynthesis Psychotherapists. Believe it or not. EFPP, yeah. And they have a summer school every year, and actually I've been invited on, I think, two different occasions to go over and teach at that summer school, and really enjoyed that. There's very active groups in Sweden. There's active groups in London. But I think the Federation is the only organization that I know of. There may be others. There may be others that I don't know about in Europe.
Uh-huh.
And now also New Zealand. There's active groups in New Zealand.
So what do you see as the future of psychosynthesis, other than the possibility of it fading away as the original old guard fades away?
I'm still doing training. I do an online training, and there's a very active training center in Amherst, Massachusetts. There's one in Kentucky. So there used to be a lot more, but there are still some remaining, and there are still people being trained in it. And I think what's happening is a lot of them are going out and integrating psychosynthesis into their practice. So they might be doing a therapy practice or a counseling practice and using psychosynthesis, but they're not teaching it.
Yes.
Per se. They're just using it. And I think there's a lot of that going on.
Yes.
I kind of wonder if one of my fantasies is that it'll kind of get rediscovered from Europe, because it's so active and healthy there, mm-hmm. that maybe somehow a spark will come from Europe and reignite something here in the United States.
Yeah. Okay. Well, as we wind down here, I wonder if there's anything you'd like to add by way of summary.
Well, I continue to feel that psychosynthesis, as I said earlier, I don't feel like it's become passé. And my appreciation for it kind of deepens. It's simple. It's really rather simple. And I think that's part of its value, is that it's not a complex, confusing structure. It's pretty straightforward. And within that structure, people can do their own thing. They can, work with it in different ways. It's not just a one way of working with it. So that's part of what I want to say, is that I've had an image of a jungle gym, that psychosynthesis is like a jungle gym, and you can climb around in that jungle. I see one of those dome jumble, you know, those dome-shaped
yeah.
ones?
Uh-huh.
And you can climb around in it any way you want to. And what's more, the different pieces are somewhat elastic. So as you climb around in the jungle gym, it moves and changes according to what you do with it. So that's my image of psychosynthesis.
Good. We end with some imagery, which is appropriate. So Molly Young Brown, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
I've thoroughly enjoyed talking with you.
I was gratified to discover how much I recall from my training in psychosynthesis more than 40 years ago. I guess the instructors from way back then, Jim and Susan Varju, should get at least some of the credit. They gave out a lot of great handouts and reprints. I'm not sure I've got those anymore, but I did hang on to them for years. I may have finally dumped them when I was cleaning out my office at Sonoma State University as I was leaving for retirement. As you heard in the interview, Assagioli borrowed very liberally in creating this very integrative approach. He borrowed from Jung and Rogers and Maslow and Perls. He might have also borrowed from Viktor Frankl, for whom will was a major concern. And he borrowed from a number of Europeans, whose names I've since forgotten, for input on the use of imagery techniques, for example. I especially took the various imagery techniques to heart. In part, I suppose, because they fit so well with hypnotic approaches I was already well steeped in. So, while I never declared myself a psychosynthesis therapist, it was easy for me to roll much of the learning from psychosynthesis into my overall approach during the years I was working as a therapist while also being a professor. And I drew upon the techniques and the two theoretical charts Molly described as well in my teaching, especially my course on myth, dream, and symbol. I think today's therapists of just about any stripe will find elements in Assagioli's psychosynthesis that could easily fold into their own work. So I appreciated this opportunity to review psychosynthesis with Molly Young Brown. If you'd like to learn more, you can purchase Molly's book that we mentioned, Unfolding Self, The Practice of Psychosynthesis, using our Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar on our site.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Jacinda Duke in Wellington, New Zealand, and I just made my second donation this week, and it feels good. And so all of you listeners out there who haven't put your hand in your pocket yet, I strongly encourage you to, so we can continue to enjoy this wonderful service that's been provided. Keep it up. Love it. Thanks.
Thank you, Jacinda. They're down under. If you aren't already on the donor honor roll on our website, how about taking Jacinda's advice and making that commitment and getting your name up there right away for the whole Shrink Wrap Radio community to see and to derive inspiration from your action? I previously mentioned that we have two new continuing education courses offered through the Zur Institute. And they are Holistic and Nutritional Approaches to Treating Psychological Disorders for 5 CEs and Holistic Psychotherapy, Treating the Whole Person for 6 CEUs. Let me remind you that there is a new 43-unit certificate course that includes the two above plus additional material, and it's called Complementary and Alternative Medicine for 43 CE units. Now, to see the details, just go to www.zurinstitute.com/online_certificates.html. And remember, you can get 10% off any and all Zur Institute courses using the discount code DRDAVE88. That's DRDAV and the numbers 88. And speaking of discounts, our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, is also offering a discount on a course on alchemy with Jungian analysts Robbie Bosnack and Patricia Berry. The 10 sessions of this course are spread out over 2 years. You can attend the 10 live webinar sessions and will also receive an audible recording of each session. And you'll find the dates and the other details on our Shrink Wrap Radio website under the Partners tab. And the cost for that course is $150, but you can receive a 15% off discount by using the code Dr. Dave, and that's just D-R-D-A-V-E. Shrink Wrap Radio is also an affiliate for the Apple iTunes Store. Shrink Wrap Radio will make a 7% commission on any music tracks or albums you purchase when you click on the little black and white iTunes banner in our left-hand sidebar that says Download in iTunes. You can also use this to purchase other products in the iTunes Store, such as iPhone apps and iBooks. Australian listener and transcriber Gloria Ullman let me know that she was able to make some purchases this way, so we know it works, and not just in the U.S. Finally, let me remind you of our affiliate relationship with Audible.com, where if you're not already a member, you can get a free book of your choice from their more than 165,000 titles. I'm a huge fan of Audible because for many years I've always had an Audible book going to listen to in my car or on walks. The novel I'm listening to currently is Jolie Blanc's Bounce by James Lee Burke. Have I already raved about James Lee Burke here? I think I might have, but I don't recall. But he's worth raving about more than once. As you know, I love a certain kind of crime fiction, and James Lee Burke is one of my all-time favorites. He's a Southern writer with that gift for writing that characterizes so many of the older Southern authors. I believe he's in his 80s now, and I dread the day we lose him. To my mind, he's the equal of James Faulkner, but because his books are in the crime genre, I guess they're not considered, quote, literature. He has a wonderful series about a New Orleans police detective named Dave Robichaux and his pal Cleet Purcell. Over the years, James Lee Burke has created a whole richly textured world inhabited by fascinating and complex characters. I've read just about everything he's written, and I think Jolie Blanc's Bounce is not his latest work, but is one that's newly been added to Audible.com. The reader is not the one who's read all the other books in the series, so that was a bit jarring and disappointing to me at first, but he's good enough that I can still enjoy the book. He's got that. He's got the proper accent for Southern Louisiana. So on those grounds, it works. So if you'd like to listen along with me, and you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this book for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, you don't have to read Jolie Blanc's Bounce. Any James Lee Burke book will do. Or, as I said, they have 165,000 other titles for you to choose from.
I've got the key to the highway, feet up and ready to go. Oh, I'm listening to Dr. Dave, that old shrink wrap radio. Now when the moon peep on the mountain, I'll be on my way, listening to that quiet little voice. I walk along life's old highway. I've got the key to the highway, got myself freed up and I've got to grow. Oh, taking to the air now, walking's most too slow. So come with me now, people, let's go explore the great unknown. We got the key to that inner highway, that's where we're meant to roam. So open up your hearts now, people, it's the only way to grow. Love is the key to that highway, You heard it on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Yeah, we're talking Key to the Highway, baby. Thanks so much to listener Justin Cobble for putting that together for us. I was so thrilled to have such a competent, genuine blues artist as Justin in our audience here. Look for Justin Cobble on YouTube and also Justin Cobble Music on Facebook. And you spell his name JustinCable. If Justin has inspired any other of you musicians out there, let me know. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. I'll read just one today. Hi, Dr. Dave. How are you? Your show has positively impacted the way I approach so many things, like my inner life, my family, friends, and coworkers. I've also noticed that I approach coaching differently. After a hiatus of 2 years, I have two boys in wrestling again, which is a very demanding sport because it is simply win or lose. A young person can't see past that. I've found that I don't take it as personally when my kids don't do as well as others. I also have found that I want them to not take it too seriously and welcome distractions while we wait for matches to come up. I was wondering if you have any information on sports psychology. I think the area of muscle memory is fascinating, but also dealing with the cognitive aspects of anticipating an event is important. Do you have any book recommendations in this area? I noticed that episode number 88 addresses this area, but it isn't available for download through your app or my Android podcasting app. And that's signed Kelly. Well, hi, Kelly. I'm so glad to hear that the show has impacted you so positively. I'm afraid that sports psychology is a bit of a hole in my interview offering, and I have to confess here that I was a bit disappointed in episode number 88. If anyone has a suggestion of a real leader in the field of sports psychology, let me know. Meanwhile, I'm wondering if you heard my interview with Irish psychologist Declan Ahern. Our interview on Shrink Wrap Radio number 409 was about mindfulness, but he did mention that both he and his son are involved as sports psychologists there in Ireland. I think there may be some hints about their approach in that interview, as I recall. And as for some readings that would help your boys not to get so anxious in anticipating the next event, mindfulness actually, I think, would be the key, and I've done a number of interviews here on mindfulness and also recommended a number of books that have been written by my various authors on that topic. So I think if you study the site a little, you can find a good choice on your own. And so I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to Molly Young Brown for filling us in on the present, past, and future of psychosynthesis. And my next interview will be on recovering from trauma with trauma coach, speaker, and author Michelle Rosenthal. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.